We are live. Welcome back, everybody. I hope you're all doing great today. This is the Dubai Life Podcast, and we've got a great show lined up for you all. So in this episode, we all know Dubai is famous for the big, the brash, and the bold. That's right, Richard.
Indeed.
And in this episode, we're talking with one man in particular that's making this happen, Mr. Rabin Kabin, partner of world-renowned Signature Group that currently owns 7 companies in the design build industry. He's got a fascinating story, and you'll all be amazed at some of the iconic projects that he's been involved with, really shaping this city's identity, in my opinion. But first, Richard, talk to me. What's going on out there? What's this about Dubai opening up again? I hear some talk about potentially things starting to slowly open up and people being able to get outside again.
I think so. I think it's got to come, hasn't it, Liam? You know, we can't be on this lockdown forevermore, shall we say. And like sooner or later, we've got to make steps to open ourselves back up and go out into the world again. But the flip side is we can't do it too soon or we can't rush at it. If we do that, we've lost everything. You know, the last 2 months almost have been a wipeout. So again, the release into the press, aren't they? What has to happen? A gradual reopening of Dubai, but again, it's quite a strict way of doing it. For example, today they've just released that for the malls, and I know you're not a mall guy, but I am, and I do like pottering the mall on a Friday or a Saturday morning before the crowds get there. But on a mall now, it's quite strict. They're talking about only having 30% capacity open in the car park, 30% capacity in every single store in the mall. Wow. A separate entrance, a separate exit. You must wear gloves. You must wear masks. You must have your temperature taken. But at any given time, they're only going to allow 30% of the capacity into a shop or even a food outlet in the food hall. Great. It must be a nightmare for the proprietors of the business.
Really difficult.
Anything that's touched and not taken must be sanitized. And if you can't sanitize the products, it's too delicate or whatever, it's going to go into quarantine. So, straight away, it's 30% or 70%, isn't it? 70% of natural flow, natural business money through the tills. It's not happening. No. And again, I read yesterday that it was 45 minutes just to enter into Carrefour in the Mall of Emirates.
Yeah, I saw that as well. I saw a video.
And they were snaking right back round the sort of the corridors, etc. Yeah. So, you know, the pain of going to a mall, I think, for the foreseeable future, and I really do feel for these guys.
Yeah.
Far outweighs the pleasure aspect, even for me. And like for somebody like you, I'm sure you're going to venture to a mall for a long time to come.
Yeah, I'm just not going to bother, to be honest. I think this lockdown has taught me the beauty of online retail. We've ordered everything online, all the shopping. We've ordered just all the essentials. We've not needed to leave the apartment. It's not great. We're in a one bed. But we haven't really, I've not felt the urge to go shopping. I mean, I don't understand what is so important that you have to go to the mall. With all this going on, apart from shopping, maybe some things that you can't get online, but I don't understand what else you'd need to get out there urgently for.
Go on, admit it.
Medical supplies, I get that. Food, I get that. Yeah, but everything else, no, I don't understand it.
But again, ladies like their fashion, and I know my partner, when she buys online, a lot of it goes back. So at least in the mall, you can try on clothes, that looks good on me, or no, that doesn't look good on me. So it erases the trial and error. Whereas online, when it looks totally different on the model to when it arrives in your home and you try it on here, and oh my goodness, that's not for me.
That's the only thing that I really go to the malls for, clothes, to be honest. I don't like ordering clothes online because, like you said, they always come and the size is wrong. So I like to try on the clothes. But at the moment, I'm not going to be buying any clothes because I'm not going to be going out for the next few months. I mean, Emirates have said July yesterday, before this news came out about everything potentially slowly opening back up again. But what do you think about that? July, not going to be able. Did you have any travel plans?
Yes, I did actually. I was going back to the UK for a very slight medical situation. I need to go back every 6 months just to have my skin looked at.
Right.
And I had an appointment there for the 1st of June. So I was beginning to think, okay. But then, of course, the hospital took control of the situation and notified me that they automatically put my appointment back to the end of August now. So obviously, and again, hospitals have got a million more important things to worry about me and my skin at the minute. So that's fine. And again, I don't think anybody should be rushing to visit a hospital at the moment in any circumstances unless absolutely necessary, whether that's in the United Arab Emirates or back in England. Let the professionals get on as best they can to do the job that they're so heroically doing.
Agreed.
And leave them space and time. So anyway, getting back to it, yes, I'm now looking at going back in August. And again, I saw something of how they're going to fly the planes. The middle seat of three in the rows is going to be turned backwards, if you like. So one facing forward, the middle one facing back, the next one facing forward, with plastic face guards, you know, around your chair.
Wow!
I saw that yesterday. Also, they've kitted out the cabin crew with the next level of personal protection. Visors, full overalls, if you like, to protect themselves. Interesting times, isn't it?
I mean, when
it is. Again, we were talking about this so many times, and like it slowly dawns on you, it slowly drops into position. My God, we're not going back to a world that we knew before this.
Yeah.
Again, office. I'm not going to rush to the office. I mean, I hope the bosses aren't listening, but. I don't want to, the nicest possible. I love my colleagues, and you know, I love the banter of the office, but I don't want to be sitting with 25, 30 people, not knowing their provenance, who they've been with, where they've come from, etc.
Yeah.
You know, we're out meeting clients from all over the world. We can do this from home. And again, I'm going to limit my visits to the office, shall we say, and do everything hopefully virtually. And hopefully, it won't impact on my expertise, my business levels, and my income. You know, but let's be sensible about this. It's as simple as that.
Yep.
Let's not expose ourselves unnecessarily. If we can do the business without exposing ourselves to mass social contact, which is a real shame, we've got to do it. We've got to think about other people.
Exactly. You've got to think about those. Older people perhaps, or the ones that are more at risk, and you've just got to do what's right, haven't you? I mean, personally for me,
I'm a lot older than you, Liam.
I don't think you're in the major risk category just yet, but I think this for me, it's taught me that I am quite productive at home. I've never had to work from home before, but I'm reasonably satisfied with the work that I'm getting done, so there'll be no immediate rush back for me to the office, even though I do like being in the office environment. Just touching back a little bit to your expertise that you mentioned there, we saw some new market data released. According to Cavendish Maxwell, rents in Dubai have dropped by 14% for apartments and 10% for villa and townhouses. So talk to me, give the listeners some advice. If you're living in a rented property in Dubai, you obviously want to maximize. You want to benefit from this situation. Rents have clearly been coming down. But how do you start negotiations and keep the relationship with your landlord? You know, you don't want it to be too...
You just said it there. You just said the key word, relationship.
Yeah.
We're in it together. They want a good tenant in their property, and you want to stay in a good situation. And, of course, no one wants to pay more rent than they have to. But it's a question of picking your battles and picking your timing. There's no good going to a landlord and demanding 20,000 off or 30,000 off the price unless that's very realistic and you've got backup proof to prove that the surrounding villas, the surrounding apartments in your area are transacting at that level.
Yeah.
You need to go to the landlord and say, look, Mr. Landlord, you know, you're a sensible guy. We've been good tenants for you. We've been paying this rent and now I can prove to you by this, and I hope you agree, that the going rent for your place should be in this region. And here's some proof to prove that. And again, I wouldn't personally go into negotiations unless it was for a sizable drop. It's no good for 5 or 10,000. I'd rather keep my powder dry for the following year and get a substantial reduction.
Yeah.
Because we can't, you know, we can't keep doing this every year. You can't keep going back to your landlord every year and say, you can, again, as I say, if it's proven that the drop is there, but for 5,000 off the price every year, no. You're building a relationship with a landlord that if things get tough with your job or whatever, you can turn around to him and say, look, I've been very fair with you, Mr. Landlord, and you've been fair with me, so let's keep working together. I've been in my place for 4 years, and luckily I've got an excellent relationship with my landlord. He looks after me very well. Richard, you know, is it all right to pay the next rent check-in, et cetera? Do you want me to wait a while? All this kind of stuff. You know, maintenance is very good as well. Yeah. We like each other. We trust each other. And that's a lot of things to do going forward. Please bear that in mind. You need each other. Bear that in mind, please.
Yeah. And I mean, that's all well and good. You've got it seems to be a really nice guy as a landlord or a woman, I'm not sure. But what happens to the tenants that, you know, we know there's people out there who are just completely unreasonable. They're not willing to negotiate. They feel that they've got a tenant and that's the price that they should get. Where can a tenant go for advice and guidance and help to try and get, you know, something? Is there anything legally that that tenants are entitled to?
In our business, we have the rental dispute committee at RERA, the RDC, land department, and that's there for, you know, the end of the line when there's absolutely no chance of negotiation, no chance of communication, and one party feels so aggrieved that they have to sort of almost take legal steps.
Yeah.
But again, it's not an easy and simple path to follow. You have to lodge a certain proportion of your rent just to have the case heard. Stop any simple, oh, he refused to change my light bulb in my bedroom, so I don't think that's fair. So you've got to lodge 3.5% of the annual rent. Yeah, just to have the case said. You don't need to go that far unless it's the last chance saloon, shall we say.
Yeah.
What you need to do is speak to a good broker who's proved that he's honest and trustworthy, who's not in it for commission, he's in it to give a good service, and he'll give you, if he's a specialist in that area with many years experience, he'll give you his advice and his thoughts, and then you sort of like pad that out and then go and speak, because you've got the relationship with your landlord. It clearly states on most tenancy contracts that once we've actually brokered the deal as brokers, that's when we finish our business. Of course, a good broker doesn't. A good broker is available for a week or two and he moves in to help with the teething problems. But a year or two into the situation, it really is down to yourself and your landlord to talk sensibly. You know, landlords aren't silly. This is their business. They want, you know, income coming in. They don't want an empty unit standing empty for 2 or 3 months, losing that much rental income. Now, within the best possible reason, most should be reasonable and give a fair reflection on things.
Fair point. Very, very well advised. And I guess for tenants, if you can't agree the price, have a look at the market. There might be plenty of options cheaper. And if it
there
makes
are plenty of options,
the moving costs, moving costs, and obviously the 5% agency fee, then it, you know, worst case scenario, you can.
You've got to say. There are plenty of options and probably cheaper than where you are now. But then you've got to weigh other factors as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
You've got to weigh, as you say, you're going to be paying agency fees.
Yeah.
You've got to be paying moving costs. You've got to then go through the hassle of Ijari and connecting D-ware and getting chiller if that's needed, etc.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things to take on board. But sometimes, you know, a change is necessary. You know, sometimes you think, I need to change environment and it'll be a better situation. And certainly, as we all know, there's supply in the market at the moment for most people to get what they're after.
Yeah, it is a hassle and it's not always great moving in Dubai to different places, but I've done it 5 times now and it's been nice experience in different communities and different ways of life. So we've lived on the Palm. We had our own beach. Well, not our own beach. We had the beach there to use, which was great for friends and family visiting. And then we've lived in the marina. So we're enjoying the hustle and bustle of Dubai city life. Talking.
Do you see yourself in the marina? Do you see yourself being in the marina for a bit longer?
Yeah, I do. So personally, my rent's coming to fruition in June, and we've already kind of given notice that we want to move just to a bigger place. But I think, we'll stay in the marina. It's got everything we need. We've been out of the 7 years I've been in Dubai, three of them have been in the marina, and yeah, can't complain. The obviously the main issue with the marina is the traffic. So as long as you can avoid that traffic close to the JBR side, then you're fine. But
you're looking at the marina gate. Yeah, so you can like get out very quickly, can't you? So yeah, it's one of the best. But it's the best quality, in my humble opinion. It's one of the best towers there, best access, best best place for most amenities. Yeah.
Yeah,
I like Marina Gate.
It really is good. So talking about you know, properties that we like, last week or last episode we touched on what we would buy with $1 million. So let's up it a little bit now. Let's talk about the next category. So if we say 3 million dirhams as a gift to you to buy a property, where are you buying, Richard, and why? Sounds like blind.
Right, okay. Where
would you?
You're on the spot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Well, I started off in Dubai in Arabian Ranches. Ranches 1, for that matter. Arabian Ranches 2 wasn't even on the ground then. And I like Arabian Ranches 1. I like the greenery. But I'm going to come back to that in a second.
Okay.
Notable shouts for pure size and decent quality, and they got most things right, would be Moudon across the road. Oh. You know, Moudon, you're getting some very nice villas in Rahat, built by the Dubai property, good quality, spacious, enormous places compared to Emaar across the road there. Again, Moudon is that age where they weren't over generous on most plots, but the corner ones are enormous. They really are. So Moudon's a very good shout. Ranches 2 is a nice bet as well. You've got a very nice mall there. You've got a Fitness First actually on site, whereas in Ranches 1, you don't have a gymnasium. As you can see, I am a gym buddy.
Yeah.
But anyway, but there is good sports facilities on Ranches 2. And again, Emaar up their game. They learned their lessons and like up their design. Yeah. So again, I like Casa. Casa was pretty. Yeah, it was the first community, wasn't it? And now it's just, it's what, about 4 years old, I think now. So it's established. It's green. Plot sizes again. I'm English and I come from a farm in England, so I like my privacy.
Yeah.
But there's some nice plots there, and again, you can walk very easily to the centre there. So I like Casa. But having said all that, I'm going back to my roots. I'm going to go back to Arabian Ranches 1, where it's so green and peaceful and spaced out. And for my 3 million, I'm going to pick myself up a Sahil or a Savannah.
Okay. Big plot.
Which are very Art Deco, Art Nouveau in their design. Full-length windows, very square. But these are fantastic villas because they are now, what, almost 20 years old. So they are beginning to show their age, but you can pick up a good one. And then with a little bit of vision, and this is where I want to be speaking to Robin later, with a little bit of vision and interior design, you're going to create yourself a beautiful, like, LA Hollywood Hills home there.
Nice.
Mostly back onto parkways. You're close to pools. You're close to everything. I like Arabian Ranches 1. So I like the green, the peace, and the tranquility of it. That's me. That's the villa boy. What about you, Liam? I'm going to take it down. What about you?
I mean, look, I've got to give a plug out to my area. Obviously, Sidra has got a sweet spot with me. It's a property, a project that's close to my heart, where I've worked for the last sort of 2 years. And I really do like what Emaar have done. Very contemporary designs, all open plan. The best part about Sidra for me, and the part where I see most people surprised, is just the amount of light that comes into those properties. They've been really well designed. Lots of floor-to-ceiling glass throughout the property. So they're all really bright and feel spacious. Big high ceilings. All bedrooms have built-in wardrobe space as well. And for 3 million, you'd be looking at a really well-located three-bedroom, 3,100 square feet, plot size sort of 4,500 up to 5,000 square feet. So not huge, but you do have fantastic landscaping throughout Sidra. So you've got Sidra 1 and 2 are connected with a big, huge central park. And then you've got separate parks which branch off, where you've got tennis, football, volleyball, basketball courts. It is designed, I think, more towards young families. At the moment, I don't have a young family. So I have to be honest, if somebody gave me 3 million dirhams right now in my hand and said, you've got to buy a property with it, I'd probably look in Marina Gate where I am now. Like we've just said, for all those reasons, you miss out the traffic of the marina, but you get all of the benefits. So, you know, you've got, there's a Fitness First opening up, but you've got a sauna, steam room, which
you've got an excellent gym, though, haven't you?
You've got an amazing gym.
I've been blown away. Yeah, yeah. Every time I go to the marina, the gym blows me away. The ease to get onto the boardwalk, everything, you know. So they've got it right in Marina Gate. Apart from the lifts, you need a degree in electronics to work out the lifts.
You need a bit of patience with those lifts. The only thing that really annoys me with Marina Gate is that they have the cards, access cards, to get into the building. Then you've got to get the access card out again. So when you're parking, you've got your parking access card. Fine, you're in the parking. Then you've got an access card to get into the lift lobby. Then you've got to use your access card again in the lift. And it's just too much. If you're carrying a big, you know, pile of shopping, you've got to keep getting your card out all the time. It's just an inconvenience. But... And
so if Selector are listening,
and they're not cheap.
So if Selector are listening, that's a bit of feedback for you there, Selector.
Exactly.
The developer.
I'm sure they are listening, and hopefully they're taking notes. I'm not happy with the card situation, but everything else is fantastic. The swimming pool is, you know, it's an Instagrammer's paradise. You just see influencers sat around the pool all day taking selfies. The gym's incredible.
What does 3 million get you in Marina Gate?
3 million, I could potentially get you a 3-bedroom, I think. There's a couple advertised. They're usually a little bit more than that, and originally they were. But if you found the right seller, I think you could probably look at about a 2,000 square foot 3-bedroom, ideally with a full marina view. And you know where Marina Gate's positioned, you're looking right down the marina. It's fantastic. You get a high floor. Four bathrooms, 3 bedrooms, 2,000 square feet. That'd do me.
That's 3 million well spent. Very well spent indeed. Because again, what an investment, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Why would you ever have to sell that? Yeah, indeed. Fantastic. Yeah. Good shout.
Really like that. So we're not far now, I don't think, from Rubin joining us. Yeah. Anything else that you've seen in the press?
A couple of other things I wanted to talk about. Again, I've got to salute the Dubai government and the UAE government.
Yeah.
Very quietly, they have welcomed 13 stranded cruise ships into Dubai. When you read in the press about Miami and Japan and places like that having a real political storm about accepting these cruise ships, because the cruise ships, one or two, have been hotbeds of COVID-19, and they've just been horribly turned away. No, you're not landing. You're not. Yeah. You're not coming into port. Stay away. We don't want
humane,
you.
Isn't it really?
But very humane, which again goes back to the tolerance of Dubai. So, salute to the government. They have quietly, not a big fanfare. They have actually welcomed 13 cruise ships, over 8,000 people, with the medical support to test every single passenger and crew member, disembark them, and then flown them off quietly back to their own countries. So,
brilliant.
Salute and shout out to the government for taking a grasp of the situation there. Yeah. And then one final thing before Robin joins us, Ramadan. I think it's going to start tomorrow.
Tonight, isn't it?
And
I think it's tonight.
Yes, indeed. And interestingly, it's going to be a Ramadan online. You know, there's going to be a lot of things online now, you know, the lectures, the seminars, everything. On one hand, it's heartbreaking because it is a great time for family and friends to actually, you know, join together at sundown and like the prayers and the iftars, etc. But again, in the world of technology, we're going to have a month of Ramadan online. And interestingly enough, some of these seminars and lessons will be in English as well as other languages. So I think it wouldn't be a bad idea for us to like have a little dip in and just learn a little bit about the five pillars of Islam. Something that I've always been interested in since I've come to Dubai.
Yeah,
those are the things that I picked up on. What about you? Have you been to anything?
Yeah, I mean, there's this. There's a lot of trends which are coming out of this lockdown, which are quite interesting. One of the trends is the Zoom or virtual pub quiz trend. Have you done any? I know you like your pub quizzes. Have you been involved? Have you done any? Any virtual pub quizzes?
I love my pub quizzes. You know, we used to have a luxury property pub quiz team. And we used to go to McGettigan's in JLT on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And they actually do it. But I attempt it, but I sit on my own and like, you know, my partner, bless her, she's from Thailand. So she doesn't really have much, you know, I can't say to her, who won the English Premiership in 1979? Come on, quick. So You know, it'd be like Billy No Mates on his own. So if I was with two or three friends, I'd gladly get in there.
Let's do it. Let's get involved. Maybe we should do a Dubai Life pub quiz. That's an idea for you. Maybe we could set that up and make it happen. I'll take notes. Let's get it going on Zoom. Pretty easy to get started. Speaking of quizzes, I watched the other night a series on ITV called The Quiz, and it was about the Major. Do you remember the Major that won? Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The Coffin Major.
Indeed. Everyone says it's very good. I've not seen it yet.
Really good. Definitely worth a watch. Right. I don't know how realistic it is. I heard Chris Tarrant talking about it, and he said a lot of the stuff's made up, as you would expect. But interestingly enough, it was made by ITV, and it kind of portrayed the Major not to have cheated, which seems strange because obviously they had a case against him. They went to court.
The amount of evidence was that, and even, I think the Major's admitted, we tried it, and good luck, you know, they caught us out. You know, when they told him they're going to like not pay him the $1 million, he just said, "Oh well, fair enough."
Yeah.
You know, and if I'd won $1 million, and somebody said to me, "You're not going to get it." Fair enough.
No chance.
World War III. But just his initial reaction. Oh yeah, so be it.
I know.
Come on, that admits the guilt. And Chris Tarrant, you know, I've read the same. Chris Tarrant is really adamant and shouting loud, isn't he, out there?
Yeah.
Ingram did cheat, you know, and there's not too much argument coming back from Ingram. So anyway, no. I need to watch it. I will watch
it. You should watch it, and I tell you who's fantastic in it. The lady from Peaky Blinders, she plays one of the barristers, and she's unbelievable. She convinces me that he didn't do it, but obviously I think he did. Where's Robin? Has he messaged you?
No, I think I said you sent him an invite.
I sent him an invite. Let me make sure he's got it. He's received it and he's replied. Perhaps he's not got the link working yet. Let me just double check. I think he should be. See you at 12:30. Thanks, gents. Noted. So he should be online soon. I'll get a message when the invite pops up, and I'll just add him into the call. Where did you first meet Robin?
Robin actually was introduced to me from one of our colleagues on the Palm, and he's done some good work in the Palm.
Yeah.
And you should show some examples of his work there. But also, he's done a lot in Dubai Hills on the Parkway and Fairways Mansions.
Yeah, the Hills Grove Mansions as well, I believe. The Street of Dreams.
Yeah, you can like quiz him more on that. But I found him to be a really nice professional guy and some amazing vision. It really is. And as I say,
I'm looking forward to it. It'll be good to have a chat with him. A lot of the stuff I work with, as you know, is Shell and Co. So it's always challenging for me when I take a client into a Shell and Co property. You need a certain amount of inspiration. You need an understanding of what can be done. And if you're not from that background, it's difficult for a lot of buyers, I find, to picture themselves living in a Shell and Co villa because it's just a vast shell with a lot of concrete. Right, Robin is here. Let's add him into the call. And
very, very fascinating guy. A guy who can park a Lamborghini on a table for art. So we're going to ask him about that. Anyway.
Perfect. Here we go. He should be coming on any moment now. Hopefully his Wi-Fi is strong. Robin, how are you? Welcome to the Dubai Life podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Very good indeed.
So,
can you hear us okay?
You can hear us okay? Signal's good?
Yeah, everything is fine. Thank you.
You've gone now. It's perfect.
Okay. Well, since you you know Robin, Richard, why don't you kick things off?
Okay. Hi, Robin. How are you? All good?
Very well. Thank you so much.
Good, good. So, before we get into your very fascinating and interesting story, I'm fascinated at the minute how business owners and business leaders are finding everyday life in Dubai. How are you finding things with your design company?
Well, we've been around for a period. So I believe this is the second financial crisis or financial holdup that we've been through. So we have since 2013 prepared for this kind of. By, among other, mobilizing a team to work from home. So I would say the unfortunate situation that has occurred has actually not struck us so hard. So we're quite happy for that.
Yeah. But I know you've got several projects on the go. How are you managing on a day-to-day basis? I mean, how many works have you got under you on your projects at the moment? How are you finding things or running those projects at the moment?
Well, we've been very fortunate. It's not been a complete lockdown in the construction field. You have certain communities like Al Barari where they have imposed restrictions despite of the authorities otherwise giving the okay. But our larger projects, and for example, Dubai Hills, those have not been affected at all from the, let's say, as a developer, or as a, from a design point of view. However, the contractors have suffered a little bit of restrictions. For example, they cannot bring all their labor to site in one go. They have to put a certain limited amount of labor in their buses and seat them in a specific sequence, right, which means that instead of doing one trip, they probably have to do three trips. But other than that, we're very lucky. The majority of our projects are still developing without any issues.
Okay, fantastic. Sounds good. And again, everyone seemed to be running their sort of business virtually. What have you learned from the last month or so? Are you going to take anything from this into the future running of Casa Prestige?
Well, like I said, back in 2013, I read a book by Richard Branson where he, in fact, mobilized a lot of his teams and basically told them, listen, we don't care how the work gets done. You don't need to come into the office as long as the work gets done.
Yeah.
So in 2013, where we saw still, you know, the financial situation globally not picking up as fast as it should, and, you know, with the rising expenses locally, be it for office space or, you know, the imposed governmental fees, medical and so on, all those, costs rising, and at the same time, the market is getting more and more competitive. It's getting more and more saturated. So we made a decision where we asked our employees, which were almost 100 sitting in the office at any given time. We said, listen, guys, either we'll let you go or you'll take a small percentage pay cut, but the majority of your salary, which is estimate 80%, you would get in your hand. However, you have to work from home. So our teams were actually from India, Sweden, Pakistan, from Ukraine, and almost all of them opted to keep their salaries and work from home in their home countries. What that eventually meant was for us as employees, as employer, our office space became smaller. Mm-hmm. And we benefited from a lot of other factors, such as we don't need to get visas, we don't need to pay medical, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But the biggest benefit, which was for both parties, as employer and as employees, is that there were suddenly a lot less politics, you know, usual office politics where employees argue. And also, they're constantly surrounded by their family and friends and kids and so on. So, in fact, the performance from a psychology point of view went up. And all the excuses, which is, I'm stuck in traffic and we have to, you know, force them to, you know, dress in a certain presentable way when we are having them in the office, because we were having an open plan office where the clients would see the employees, so they cannot come in sneakers and so on. So all those little details benefited us largely. And whilst most employees were giving at least 50% of their salaries for rent and barely sending anything back home, all of a sudden they're living like kings back home because they're maintaining the majority of their income. So it was a very good decision that we made back in 2013. So when all of a sudden the office, the restrictions this year basically were imposed, we were almost not at all affected. I would say the only way we got affected is the people around us, because naturally when you develop such projects, you're not working only your team, but you're hiring contractors, you're hiring subcontractors, you're hiring other specialists. Naturally, you are dependent on a lot of governmental entities to give you approvals to, you know, build a three-story villa, four-story, you got your lifts, you got your, you know, RTA approvals and all that. So that slowed us back down a little bit. But luckily, a lot of the approvals online has still been ongoing pretty well. So I would say the biggest slowdown was not from the government side of you, but again, it was from people, suppliers, who are basically using the situation to be on vacation. So I always kept reminding everybody, listen, we have to be working harder than ever. We are not on vacation. So please don't even utter the words COVID-19. That's been basically our biggest challenge, because you have the, I would say, the people who are not really serious in what they should be doing in their work, using it to basically not work. Yes. Exactly. And naturally, it's rarely the business owners that would make such a decision. It's usually the employees that would jump at a situation like this, where they don't need to work, and come up with an excuse. And typically, when we escalated the matter to their employers, the employer says, well, I've given you a laptop, I've given you a phone, I've given you allowance to do the work, so what is preventing you, employee, from doing your work? So other than that, us as a business, like I said, we're already used to it. We're already working from home, using only laptops, and so on and so forth.
You're quite streamlined then. You're quite streamlined for this anyway, so that's good to know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, another thing,
No, go on, please.
Another thing is, you know, usually the type of labor which you use locally, you know, being from Pakistan, India, and so on, they tend to get intimidated when they work with, let's say, people like us, the business owners. Usually they say nobody likes their bosses. But all of a sudden, they don't get to see us, only they get to hear us.
Different relationship that they have with you.
Exactly, the relationship has actually grown, because in many ways they don't get intimidated by us, and the instructions they receive whilst in the office, they had to make note of it real quick. Now they're receiving it in a recording, probably by WhatsApp or email, and they get the opportunity of revisiting that many times over, so the efficiency of work actually increased drastically. So we truly do believe that Richard Branson's way is the correct way, which is, in the future, there will be no offices. Everybody's going to be working from exactly where they're sitting, regardless of, you know, office and so on.
I think our bosses are looking at this as well, thinking, do we need as big an office as we've got? You know, why don't we, like, downsize the office space? I think an office is still important to bring clients to around a board table, etc. But to see 25, 30, 40 employees in an office from 8:30 till 6 o'clock in the evening, I think perhaps these days are numbered now.
Absolutely.
I think this this whole scenario will be a kickstart for the new age of business. And I think a lot of companies are there at the moment thinking exactly the same things that you've just said. Why do we need to be spending so much on visas and office equipment when we can adapt, and it's clear that we're still doing good business. Why do we need to waste so much money and time? And like you said, people are more efficient. One thing that I've realized is how effective I am at home. I wasn't sure before because I never had to do it. So, yeah, interesting. This could be the start of the new era of business.
Absolutely. The only thing is clients, they tend to want to be working with large companies where they can see a big office. They want to see a lot of employees. So they know that they're not signing.
It's with, not just, yeah.
Exactly. With a small company that maybe doesn't have employees, a one-man show, and so on. But that is typically an easy thing to get around, which is, okay, try us. You go and do one area trial or two areas trial with a certain company which you feel are bigger and so on, with a big office, many employees, and try us as well. And again, it comes down to the work. We're infinitely more efficient, and I believe, Richard, you've seen that. And basically, a mere 1 or 2 days, we were able to produce a lot more work than some of these setups, which have 100 plus employees in their office.
So anyway, let's get into you, Robin. Now that we've heard how you're coping today, what brought you to Dubai? When did you come? And what is your background? Was it always interior design, or did you start off in another field? Tell us a bit about yourself.
All right. So I wouldn't say that I'm an exemplary model of how a designer should be. What I knew from a very young age is that I like to draw. So that was a good start. Then I had the opportunity of going into fine arts, which means painter, some sort of artist in a gallery, versus somebody that would actually be able to make a living out of it, because statistically less than 1% of artists are able to make a living off of their artwork. So I made the correct decision of going into the business side of design, which is everything related to, and this is one thing, when it comes to design, whether I'm designing cars, whether I'm designing fashion, whether I'm designing architecture, mm-hmm. interiors, landscape, product design, all these are basically having as core the same mindset, which is problem solving. So indeed, you see an issue, which you see a problem a human is facing, being not sitting comfortably in a chair, or not feeling grand enough when they enter a lobby, or sitting in a car that have safety features, but how is that hidden? So the design in general, we can say across all fields, are the same. It is having to do with problem solving. In fact, the first field I chose within design was fashion. However, very quickly I realized that it was making me a bit more feminine than I would like to be. I was extremely popular. Other people from other universities used to come and see my work, like from a very beginning in university. And that was, in fact, in London. So I then quickly jumped to automotive design, which is the exact opposite.
Yeah, very masculine, very tough, man.
Get back the more masculine trait. Again, extremely easy, a lot of fun. I would say that it's definitely something that I still have on my wish list, which is in the not very distant future, I would like to design a car and have it built.
Nice.
However, what I faced in automotive design and in general transportation design is that you're extremely limited because you have to sit down in it. It cannot be too big, otherwise it cannot be maneuvered.
Yeah.
So the canvas on which I could be creative was quite limited. Mm. And finally, the decision I made was to move into architecture, where essentially you have many hundreds of square meters of space on which you can get creative. So I finished my bachelor's in London, actually, in architectural. And then finally, I ended it with a master's degree in Italy in interior design. So I was then well-versed in not only the overall look, but in the finer detail and design of the interiors and so on. And in between, I did many courses in Los Angeles and Germany. I even interned with Lexus in Tokyo just to understand how these different design fields work and what is the efficiency benefits or the factors in which these different companies were operating. I remember then coming to answer your question, Richard, why did I choose Dubai finally? I remember when I finalized my degree in master's in interior design in Florence, we were all sitting around the table, the graduates, and everybody was saying where they're going to go next, where they're going to do next. So of course you have the wealthy, my dad is giving me a job in his company. But as people were saying, I'm going to Miami, to New York, somebody was going to London, and so on and so forth, I said, I don't know, maybe I'll go to Dubai.
No,
wow. As soon as I uttered the word Dubai, everybody around the table went, whoa, because, you know, Sheikh Mo is extremely intelligent, and the propaganda and the reputation he has built for Dubai was basically echoing all the way back in 2005, 2006.
Wow.
So that was 2006.
Exactly. So 2005, 2006, that's when I entered Dubai for the first time.
And did you have a position here to come with? Or did you just come?
Exactly. So the first job I had, I basically got fired within the first 2 months. because again, you know, unfortunately, what they teach you in school is quite different from how design actually works in real life.
Okay.
So there was a lot of terms I was not familiar with, and I was designing things which were basically too dream, could not ever be realized because they were too expensive.
Yeah.
What, like Lamborghinis on tables?
I didn't say that we need to stop dreaming, but there's a specific way of executing dreams.
So I know I'm probably jumping ahead of myself, but how did that come about? Why did you decide to put a gold-plated, I think it was a two-ton Lamborghini on a 22-seater dining table? That is really out there, isn't it? What made you think of that?
So basically, one of the projects we were fortunate in being a part of was the Lamborghini showroom, and the one that you see now in Shahzad Road. And that is a very much toned version of the initial proposal we had given. The initial proposal had a penthouse on the roof. It would have hydraulic lifts to have special parties in this penthouse. The reaction of Lamborghini was, it's amazing, but it cannot be more amazing than the cars.
Got it.
Because the buyer, they need to focus on the cars. So since then, we have actually been discussing that design to be actually the Lamborghini Museum in Torino.
Got it. Same design as Dubai.
Exactly. So it's much more grander than
the one that you've had with the penthouse. Yeah. Nice.
Exactly. So when they're getting guests coming from abroad, they don't put them into a hotel. Rather, they put them into the actual Lamborghini. We can call it almost hotel-like, top of their museum. So the original design is still being discussed to be used. But coming to the point of why we, so that explains basically why we collaborate with Lamborghini and continue to do so to date. The reason why it was not the Gallardo, it was the Huracan, it did not create impact enough when it entered the market.
Okay.
It was, and even in my opinion, unfortunately, I don't think the car is aggressive enough. Lamborghini is known to be crazy as opposed to Ferrari, for example, which is a bit more classy.
Classic, yeah.
So the Huracan is not as aggressive as it should be. So as we were participating in Index had given us a prime location saying, please take this and do one of your crazy shows, because a few years before that, we always do stunts. We don't like to just create a stand and have something, you know, conventional.
Yeah.
The few years before that, if you continue Googling, Richard, you'll see like 25 different models dressed in very, we can say, provocative outfits.
please
do Google it. So basically, when Lamborghini found out that we're doing another one of our crazy shows in Index, they said, well, can you take this Huracan and kind of like bake it into your overall design and stand and, you know, highlight it in a way? So the first thing we decided to do is, we have to build a table that can hold a 2.5-ton car.
Yeah.
And it cannot look like all steel. It has to look like very refined. So if you actually look at the dining table, you'll see a lot of beautiful carving underneath it. That's basically the shell that went under the actual steel structure to hold this.
Got it.
Then we asked Lamborghini to gold foil the car. Because we wouldn't just have a yellow Lamborghini. Definitely. That would be too low key.
Yeah, of course.
So they went ahead and did that. Of course, Dubai, the reporters, they blew things out of proportion. And they actually said when posting it in newspapers that it's actually gold.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Of course they did. Dubai, right?
In any case, when the driver from Lamborghini arrived, to tell you the slightly longer version of the story, there was too much petrol in the car.
Oh.
So they all of a sudden slapped them with the notice that you have to have a certain amount of fuel in the car. Otherwise, if it catches fire, it becomes an explosion. So the driver hands me the keys and goes, can you try to empty the tank?
Perfect. I think so. I'll do my best.
So I was high speeding with this Lamborghini around the trade center, I don't know, for like half an hour. And it was quite a lot of fun. Anyways, I bring back the car and it's time for him to reverse the car onto the table via a long ramp.
Okay.
Somebody did not brief the guy and he was terrified and he goes, I'm refusing to do it. So that responsibility also I inherited. I did call the Jaziri brothers. I'm like, listen, if I, because I'm not a professional driver in that way per se. If it does fall down, it's not on me, okay?
Yeah.
you literally drove onto the table.
Yeah, I had to reverse the car back onto the table and not nose first. Because the way the table was positioned, you have to reverse it into place. That was a nightmare, but it was a lot of fun, ultimately.
Yeah. Wow.
Quite a challenge there as well. Anyways, that is how, and the reason why the Lamborghini was on that table, why it was gold, and
interesting.
It was an absolute success.
Yeah, it sounds like it certainly made an impact. So just going back to your start in Dubai, you said that after 1 week you got fired. I think your visions and dreams were too big and potentially not economically valid for the business you were working at. Is that right? How did you...
Unfortunately, yeah, that's definitely a big part of the truth.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And then, so you were jobless, effectively, after 1 week.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. This is why in 2005 and 2006, I kept going back and forth until I could find a better foothold and, you know, stabilize better in Dubai. So one of the decisions in terms of career, which I made after that was, okay, listen, if I'm a great designer, but obviously I'm not realistic or I don't know how to work. So instead of going to a second design job, why don't I find some kind of job where I get to sit with all designers,
yeah,
and I get to see what are the projects they're working on, their experiences. I can be friends with them and I can understand how they resolve their issues and so on. So the next position I took was actually a sales position where I was a business developer for some 20 Italian and Scandinavian brands.
Okay.
And that gave me the window of opportunity of sitting with all kinds of designers in Dubai. And understanding what projects they were working on and what kind of items they needed and how they overcame problems in their projects. So that was a very good decision. But yeah, it took me a whole year to basically learn to apply whatever I had learned in school and university in real life.
Yeah.
And in 2008, the business was going well. I was doing quite a few freelance projects. I decided to basically start Casa Prestige in Dubai.
Wow.
And fortunately, that was exactly when the economical crisis hit.
Yeah.
So I'm still very grateful for all the, let's say, challenges that have come our way since. But essentially what that meant for us was all the commercial projects such as hotels, offices, resorts, and so on, all came to a standstill.
Mm-hmm.
And the female in the household, for almost all households, they were kind of upset at their husbands for losing so much money in the stock market.
Yeah.
So they were threatening them, listen, finish my house, then you can go and spend on your cars, then you can go spend on your, you know, stocks and lose all your money. I don't care, but you finish my house first.
Okay.
So essentially what that meant was, exactly. So we basically by chance got into the residential field.
Okay. So you pivoted basically from commercial projects, hotels and malls, I don't know, to individual residential projects. Interesting.
Exactly.
Did you start small, or did you luckily get commissions for the big sort of Emirates Hills, the Palm? How did you start in residential?
I would say it was a mixture of both, because again, I was very new in the field, so I did commit. I did do quite a few errors as I was choosing projects, because I did not know how to screen clients, who actually has budget for what. So yeah, there was a lot of the commercial part, which I was still very much unaware of, but I was fortunate to get everything from Emirates Hills Villas to the one-off Hawanij local villas.
Yeah.
So we quickly became extremely renowned in the residential field. And ever since, every time we try to pull away from residential and go into commercial, somebody comes and gives us an offer we can't refuse.
So again, what, apart from the Lamborghini showroom, what other notable projects would we know of? What would the listener recognize as part of your work? Namely, one or two of the iconic buildings or villas that you've worked on.
Well, we can definitely mention one project that we were proud of, but it's not existing anymore. The Address Hotel that unfortunately caught fire.
Oh, really? Such a shame.
So we had done the lobby, we had done the presidential suites and so on. And in fact, after it burned down, we got an offer to redesign. However, the time frame in which they wanted it to be completed was unrealistic for us. And that's one of the things which we've learned down the line from choosing projects, is we do not undertake projects which we cannot handle, where we have to make false promises for the client, regardless of what project it is. So the Address that burnt down was definitely another project which we were proud of. And we have been involved in the new one, but only very few selected areas and components.
Okay.
Other things which we've done is we were involved in the Cartier showroom in the store in Dubai Mall, and some other, we can say, retail outlets. But unfortunately, a lot of the beautiful projects we've done, they're quite private.
Yeah.
Or they're so grand that some of them are still almost 10 years in the making. We do have some beautiful resorts and so on coming up, but because they're so over the top,
yeah,
it's taking time to complete. So we'll be happy to share a longer list of iconic projects with you. Probably in the coming 2-3 years.
That sounds good.
Interesting. We'll have to have a catch-up.
Yeah. What's your favourite project you've been involved with, and why?
Definitely a difficult question. It's like choosing among your babies, which one is your favourite. But I would say that, again, we have been so fortunate because every single project which we've undertaken, we have been selective with the clients. Again, we've been in a position where we can say no to a client who's paying well, even though the money is good, but we have done something like this before. Sometimes we get a royal family coming to us saying, do you know Mr. Sheikh X's mansion or palace you've done? I want the exact same thing,
yeah,
only bigger. So we would say we would love to, but we cannot do the same thing again, because these projects are extremely personal, and we have, and we show them a clause in the contract which we have, which basically says that if you ever see this design made by us again, we'll refund you all your amounts.
Exactly. So you're providing something that's unique. I like that.
Exactly.
Always.
Exactly. It's a guarantee and a half, isn't it? So
one-off projects, one-off one, nobody else would have it. And this is the type of clientele which we get, and the kind of courtesy which we can extend, because you're paying millions to develop something which should be yours, and it should not easily be replicated by somebody else.
Yeah.
Very true.
Something that's going to hold value as well, I guess.
But to answer your question again, Richard, which is a favorite, one project that we can say pops to mind, again, because it was incredibly particular, was with a certain Pakistani gentleman. He basically initially did a one of his penthouses with us in Larev, in Marina. That was a pretty straightforward, very nice penthouse we did. He basically was developing a project back in London, a duplex overlooking Hyde Park almost overlooking Hyde Park in Mayfair. He had already hired one of the top names in London to develop this project. However, I guess the designer was a bit too conventional for his taste. So he forced that designer to basically appoint us with them to develop the project. And one of the main challenges which that designer was facing was there was too much budget. They didn't know how to spend it.
What a problem to have.
I believe 60 million or 61 million exactly he wanted to spend on the penthouse.
Wow.
That's not including the purchase.
Pounds, dirhams or dollars?
Dirhams.
Wow. Still substantial, isn't it?
So yeah, it is very substantial for a 3,000 square feet. I think it was 3,000 square feet apartment. So it's not a big, very big space.
What ideas did you come up with?
Well, we have, I don't know if you've seen the movie Taken to the Greek.
Yes.
Yeah.
We actually have a hovering bed in that house.
No way.
And in his office, his wallpaper is actually $100 bills.
That's one way to spend it.
Real $100 bills.
Amazing. Wow.
Definitely a memorable project. I wouldn't say it's a favorite project, but definitely one of the memorable projects we've been involved in.
What other bizarre requests have you had?
I would say we always get clients who think they know what they need. So it's part of our duty to basically enlighten them and let them know what is actually practical and so on. And practicality is actually something which we prioritize ahead of beauty. But to mention another, we can say bizarre, request was from a certain Saudi royal family member, where he basically wanted to, as he gets out of bed at night, he doesn't want to walk to the bathroom, which was, we had designed it to only be some 10 meters away. He wanted the toilet seat to basically come to him with a push button.
That, I was not expecting that. Never heard of that before. Wow.
So it's an interesting challenge. So instead of the toilet seat with its plumbing moving towards the bed, we convinced him, okay, how about if the bed moves towards the toilet seat? So all you need to do is get up, take two steps, and you'd be next to the toilet seat. So in that way, we implemented that design, but that was definitely bizarre.
That is bizarre. That's just
taking laziness to another level.
That's madness. Amazing. Couldn't imagine it. I mean, I've seen some pretty crazy things. I'm talking about furry zebra print wallpaper and spinning lights and jacuzzis next to the bathtub, but I've never seen anything like that. That is, that's out there.
Yeah. So have you had any difficult challenges? Have you had, you know, what's when I say your worst project, there's always solutions, and I know you're very good at that, but what is your most difficult challenge you've had in interior design?
Well, in general, in architecture and interior design, I would say the most difficult challenge is the when a project is not having a clear leader. Yeah. So what the client tends to do is...
Many cooks spoil.
Exactly. And too many cooks tend to ruin the soup, basically.
Yeah.
So one of the challenges which we used to face, we don't do anymore because we are the first one to get hired. Basically, we do not want to get into disputes with the consultant on board and the landscape contractor and so on and so forth. So the our clientele have actually with time learned that they have to come to us first, where we then hire on their behalf the consultant and everybody else that needs to be involved. Not doing that means that you have, as we said, many chefs in the project and it's not coordinated. That tends to make life very difficult for everybody, client including, because he basically lands in the middle and everybody's pointing fingers. So we tend to, again, we're lucky to be very selective, but the projects that come to us where the client has already initiated certain steps, we make it very clear that either we take over in terms of management of the project, or we would reject that project because otherwise it's going to take too long and there will be too many mistakes done by the other parties.
Yeah.
And we're not entitled, we're not empowered to tell them, this is your mistake, you need to fix it. And because they haven't been appointed by us.
And it's your reputation, isn't it, at the end of the day? If you've got your name on that project and you've not got full control, then it's not worth it to risk your reputation that you've built so well over the years.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because at the end of the day, when the project doesn't go well, the client kind of feels negative towards everybody involved, including the ones that have done their jobs correctly.
Yeah.
So it's better to avoid those kind of projects.
Nice. So what do you prefer working on? Because I know you've done extensive work in Emirates Hills and the Par, which are what, 10, almost 15 years old in some cases. But I know you're doing a lot of work now on the mansions in Dubai Hills, which are pretty much brand new shell and core. I guess it's easier, isn't it, to get involved early at Dubai Hills than it is to take a dated building and start from scratch again, if you like.
That is always the case, I would say. Renovation projects tends to be more unpredictable than brand new projects. So in 2013, Casa Prestige was actually acquired by a group of companies called Signature Group.
Yeah.
So the main purpose was that all the projects that Signature Group would be having, as they are developers, Casa Prestige would be developing the design concept and overseeing the project management. So whilst Casa Prestige still operates directly with clients who have their own projects, I would say most of our projects are the ones that we basically own ourselves. In the case of Dubai Hills, we are working in two different models. There are the shell and core villas, where the project is basically purchased by a client. Now, the client is not having, for example, enough confidence in the market to pay an amount to finish the development. Because the shell and core requires all the MEP, it requires full interior design, landscape design, it requires upgrades in terms of exterior. So what we do in Signature Group is we approach these clients and we make them an offer, which is you have purchased the villa and plot for, let's say, 40 million. We'll go ahead and invest an additional 40 million on your behalf to complete the villa. When the project is complete, you have two choices. Either we sell it and we do profit share. For example, we sell it for 100 million. Each party would take 10 million after taking back their investment. And the project is sold. Or if you want to keep the villa, then you have to give us our 40 million invested plus 10 million, which is our profit, and we can conclude the deal. So this has been something which we have found that a lot of the owners in Dubai Hills have been recipient to. This is why we have around five or six shell and core villas currently. And the Signature Group is only 1.5 years old.
Very good.
And another model we've done is we basically purchase the plot and we build it ourselves and again put it back into the market for sale.
So, you're a Dubai Hills specialist. What are you
going
to say to that?
We'll have to talk. I mean, I've certainly got some clients there with the shell and core villas in Dubai Hills. And like you said, they're at a point now where do they want to be spending another 40 million dirhams to finish the project? On the other hand, you know, the market's dropped over the past 3 years since they originally bought. So do they want to take the hit and sell at the market price? And a lot of people are in that middle ground the solution that you mentioned there with the almost the underwriting, where you can finish the project and they can decide whether or not to split the profits or give you back what you paid. It's a very clever solution, and we'll talk after this because there's a few potential clients that I'm working with. I only do Dubai Hills, so I've got a good relationship with the owners there, and also some fantastic plots as well at really good prices.
So isn't that just typical Dubai? You know, just by chatting away, you know, we're like hopefully going to put two and two together. That is so Dubai in a nutshell.
For sure.
Absolutely. It's a small town.
Indeed, yeah, indeed.
Very small.
Right, okay. I think we've eaten into a lot of your time. So a couple of more last minute questions, if you like, and then we'll let you sort of go on your way, Robbie, because I know you're a very busy guy. How do you think people can use interior design to not only enjoy their property, but also to add health and wealth to the project, to the villa, or to an apartment for that matter? So basically, what tips would you give to people to improve their enjoyment of their own place, and then also to add health and wealth to it?
So one of the things which we recommend to almost all clients when starting a project is, I don't know if you gentlemen are familiar with it, Feng Shui.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So Feng Shui is basically, just to give a recap to those who are not aware of it, many centuries ago, when the Chinese emperor would choose where he wanted his next residence, he would bring his Feng Shui masters, and they would tell him if a certain plot or a certain location is good for his prosperity. What the study generally touches upon is, for example, they would analyze the client when they were born and what is the material they're made out of. So it's a bit hocus pocus. We don't need to go into too much detail when it comes to that. Generally, each one of us are either fire, earth, water, or one of these four or five elements, or wind.
Nice.
So based on that, they would recommend exactly where the client should be sleeping, how their WC should be facing, and so on. So we have our Feng Shui experts, which we appoint. For the Indian community, which is a large proportion of the clientele in this region, they have the equivalent, which is called Vastu.
Yes, we get that asked a lot. Is this Vastu compliant? Am I right in saying it's the direction of the front door? It's got to open. It's got to face northeast.
That's a small part of it. Right. That's the first thing. But then they look at the water, and like you said, the direction of the master bedroom door and the way the bed's facing and the water in the property. Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. So we've been through many cases where the client would bring their Vastu from their own side, and as soon as they love the property, but as soon as the Vastu arrives, they basically curse the place as if they're gonna get sick and die if they take this property. Yeah. And a lot of these successful people, including Westerners, they very much believe in this, so they actually cancel the deal because what the Feng Shui master or the Vastu master has said.
Well, I'd certainly only buy a property that's Vastu compliant, because there's so many believers in Dubai, and it'd be much easier to sell in the secondary market if your property is compliant. So yeah, even I would look.
Exactly. So we can say this is the psychological part of it. But again, the Vastu is based on logic, common sense, which is do not have clutter, do not build dark spaces where light cannot enter, therefore bacteria would build up and so on. So we believe that there's a lot of science behind it.
Yeah.
But generally, we feel that most projects where you have a very good balance between, bringing the outside in, be it sunlight, be it wind, air, be it vegetation, greenery. There are different ways of designing a project architecturally and interior design where you can benefit from the outside, which would eventually actually also help you in doing savings, be it power, electricity, and so on, water.
So it's quite practical.
So exactly. There's many ways of creating a healthy home, and it's not necessarily that you have to have marble everywhere. Sometimes a good stone can be a very good substitute for marble. Using wood on the walls instead of Swarovski wallpaper, whatever it may be. So there are many ways in realizing a healthy home, and it does not necessarily mean that you have to spend extra amount and that would get you a better benefit. Sometimes spending less and simplifying the design can make a much healthier home.
Interesting. Where do you think Dubai is going? As we emerge out of this, what do you think your clients will be requesting more of? You know, what do you think a trend is going to be in your design world or trends?
Well, we hope that they will, after this situation is over, we hope that they will be more aware of the environment, that they will request more green energy and green build, because we definitely need to stop behaving as if we have another planet to move to once we have consumed this one, because in fact we don't. We don't even have the means to get to the next nearest planet, let alone something that are light years away. So we hope that in general, clients take more responsibility and ask us to apply more green energy, because in fact, we can make homes completely green without any need for DEWA, without any need for almost any need for fresh water. We can make the entire house take care of itself and be completely self-sustainable. And naturally, this costs an investment up front, but in general, we can say 7 years down the line, the villa would have, or the mansion or the residence would have paid back that initial investment. So we definitely hope to see more of a trend towards green and preserving the planet. Recycling.
It's always surprised me because I lived in Spain, in southern Spain. So you drive around southern Spain and you see huge acres and acres of open fields with solar panels, or you see solar panels on roof. And yet here in Dubai, the world's city with the most sunshine, we hardly see solar panels yet, do we? Why is that?
It has to do with the cleaning of the panels, because as opposed to Europe, where you get a lot of rain and that cleans the panels, here, the panels would get dusty, and the efficiency of the panel would go down drastically after a week of not cleaning them. So that, I would say, is the main challenge. However, for example, in Sweden, where I come from, if I get solar panel and it costs me 1,000 dirhams, the government would actually give me 800 dirhams.
Yeah.
So they would encourage me to install that solar panel. Now, in Sweden, we barely get sun. So if you have that same solar panel here and the government is supporting you in installing that solar panel, or even they don't support you in installing that solar panel, because we do have so much sun, even if the efficiency of that solar panel comes down to 50% or 40%, still, because of the amount of sun, you would get a good result. So honestly speaking, this is a question which I always ask myself. Why do we not utilize solar panel more in this region? I guess it has to do with business as well, because there is a lot of money to be made from alternative energy. But also I know that you have Masdar City and so on, where you have acres and acres of solar panels. So I think it's definitely on the way. It's coming.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure about Liam, but I've got one more question. You and I, a while ago, had a conversation, and you frightened me immensely with this, because I'm so old-fashioned, I can't get my head around it. Talk to me about artificial intelligence in interior design. This is scary.
So we've had this discussion before, Richard. The word design basically originates from the fact that you have to plan with drawings something before it gets built. So essentially, you are forecasting an issue, and you have to, or a certain improvement that needs to be made. It's not an issue, but it can be improved. So the word design actually originates from the fact that we need to improve on things before they happen. So one of the experiments which we are working on with some very, very sharp millennial Indian fellows, as well as from US, is the fact that when be it you, Richard, or Liam, when you see the color yellow, it is basically an interpretation of your brain of the color yellow. It is not the fact that the object in front of you is yellow. So what we're trying to basically see, and we've done a small experiment where you have a completely white room with some boxes, we are tricking the eye and the brain to see yellow, even though it's white. Now, eventually, what that could potentially allow us to do is, if I'm having a certain interior, which is, let's say, Victorian, Queen Elizabeth-like, what prevents us from tricking the brain into, with a push of a button, instead see a completely sleek, yacht-like interior? Wow. So this is quite far in the future, but we do hope to start experimenting with this, because many years from now, I don't think the design would be static. I think as you come home and you want a cottage-like feel, you can just order it to be so. You don't have to necessarily in the physical world go and change every single furniture, ceiling, roof, walls, and so on and so forth. So we have begun in touching on this, but the amount of data that needs to be processed and how that information, the electrical impulses, are then fed into the brain, a vital component of that would be AI. So without it, it would not function. So it is something that we're definitely starting to just now scratch the surface of, and who knows, maybe we will be forced into another pandemic down the line where we have to live in an AI controlled world.
Fascinating stuff. It really is.
Yeah. Liam, have you got any questions for Ravine?
I have, yeah. So just quickly going back to that point, would that be like augmented reality? Would you have to have something on you, glasses, or would it be the physical elements of the room that change?
I don't think we need to change it at all. It is the electrical impulses in the brain that needs to be altered. That's it.
Right.
So that could simply be a little device which you place here.
Yeah. Sounds like
that. On your forehead. Sounds like Matrix, but literally what it is, basically.
Have you seen Black Mirror?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's exactly like that, isn't it? Where you can record everything.
It's the Matrix, basically.
Yeah, it's the Matrix. It's amazing.
Every week, every minute, you can change the theme, the style of your home.
It would be amazing. I mean, I get impressed with the virtual reality headsets. It still blows me away. If you get a really good quality one, you can be canoeing down the Amazon River. It's incredible. And I think that is the future.
And that's quite chunky. They're but if you look at, for example, mobile phones, how a phone used to look versus how it is today.
Yeah.
And they could even make them smaller if they wanted to, but then we would lose the phones.
Of course.
But essentially, that's what's going to happen with the goggles. Essentially, down the line, I think they're just going to be like a lens you put in. Once you put in the lens, that's it. You're basically telling the brain to see what you wanted to see, not in fact what is a reality in front of you.
100%, 100%. I do have one more question, Robin, before we go. I'm very conscious that you're busy and I know this is a lot of your time, but we are the Dubai Life podcast. So what is your ideal Dubai life? In one day, what would you like to do typically? What's your favorite spots from breakfast through to evening? What would be an ideal day in the life of Robin in Dubai?
Well, ideally, we would all have more time for each other, which is something that the situation has currently taught us. So I'm catching up with, among other, those university friends, which I have not spoken to for 10 years since I graduated.
Yeah.
So the ideal day would be that people would find time for each other, and we would all go to Drive or one of these other beautiful Dubai venues, or we can just enjoy the sun with a drink and catch up and not necessarily be forced into a lockdown to, touch base with friends and family anymore.
Yeah, nice. I like that. It certainly brought my family closer together. Being here for 7 years, we used to, there's no real way to call very often, but now we've all got time, we're at home, and we connect every evening through Zoom. So it's definitely brought us close together. That's one of the benefits with this whole situation.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Rabin. It's been really good speaking to you. I've really enjoyed the conversation, as I'm sure you have as well, Richard, and I'm sure the listeners will do as well. Where can people find you, and where can people find information about your companies?
We are quite active in social media, so perhaps we can list the different links.
I'll put it in the comments in the description.
And even if you would like to include one of our direct numbers, if they have any more questions, we're happy to receive these calls from clients, as well as even if it's competitors where they are requesting help in improving their businesses and how they can cope with the situation, we're happy to help.
Fantastic. Brilliant. All right, Rabin, pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much. And that's the wrap. Thank you.
Thank you, Robbie.
Thank you.